If you are newly back among us, you've entered in the middle of a series which we've called Why Politicians Are Bound to Disappoint Us. This is a kind of preparatory series for next week in the aftermath of the general election. And today we're looking at the life of Solomon with that heading in mind. Now, Solomon's story embraces many of the chapters of the first book of Kings. We're going to read the first part of chapter 10. 1 Kings, chapter 10, then. That's a very famous incident when the Queen of Sheba visits King Solomon. We'll just read from verses 1 to 9 of 1 Kings, chapter 10. Let's hear God's word. When the Queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon and his relation to the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. Arriving at Jerusalem with a very great caravan, with camels carrying spices, large quantities of gold and precious stones, she came to Solomon and talked with him about all she had on her mind. Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was too hard for the king to explain to her. When the Queen of Sheba saw all the wisdom of Solomon and the palace he had built, the food on his table, the seating of his officials, the attending servants in their robes, his cupbearers, and the burnt offerings he made at the temple of the Lord, she was overwhelmed. She said to the king, "The report I heard in my own country about your achievements and your wisdom is true. But I did not believe these things until I came and saw with my own eyes. Indeed, not even half was told me. In wisdom and wealth you have far exceeded the report I heard. How happy your men must be, how happy your officials who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. Praise be to the Lord your God, who has delighted in you and placed you on the throne of Israel. Because of the Lord's eternal love for Israel, he has made you king to maintain justice and righteousness." Whoever's prime minister at the end of the week, there's one quality he's going to need, and that is wisdom. Both of the major parties are internally divided, more or less obviously, and big questions face our country in the coming months and years, particularly, of course, regarding our relationship to Europe. Whoever is prime minister, they're going to require huge wisdom to keep their party together and to guide our country through those difficult waters of decision. And sadly, wisdom is an elusive quality. It's a rare quality. Someone has said, a few are wise and the rest are otherwise. To make life more complicated still, wisdom is not evenly distributed through the life of an individual either. Wisdom and folly are mixed up in the human heart, and sometimes the one shows more than the other. I suppose conventionally we assume that wisdom is going to grow as we get older, that by definition old men must be wiser than young men. But sadly that isn't true either. It's far from uncommon to find people who are wiser in their youth than they are in their more senior years. And that seems to be a particular occupational hazard where politicians are concerned, by my observation. It seems as if many a politician begins well, but somehow peters out and deteriorates as the years go by. It was certainly like that in Solomon's case. That's the reason Solomon disappoints us, as all politicians are bound to do. His wisdom failed him. I guess many of us, if we were asked, who's the greatest king of Israel, would instinctively want to reply, David. He was the king we were looking at 2 weeks ago. And in many respects, I suppose, he does qualify for that. Probably more space is spent in the Bible describing the reign of David than any other king, that's for sure. But if you look at it in secular political terms, David, in fact, was not the greatest king of Israel, not by quite a long chalk. If you measure greatness the way that we would normally measure political greatness today, his son, Solomon, far exceeds him. for power and prosperity and worldly splendor. The prize is Solomon's. In fact, never before or after did the nation of Israel ever experience such national prestige as she did as during Solomon's reign. It doesn't matter which aspect of his regime you examine, Solomon's reign is a story of enviable political success. We haven't got time to read all these chapters and examine them at the beginning of 1 Kings, but you'll find if you do read them later on today over lunch that just about everything about Solomon was great. His foreign policy, for instance, achieved unprecedented security for Israel. David had had to fight perpetual wars to protect his borders against external invaders and indeed to capture territory. But Solomon so strengthened the nation's defenses that Israel's former enemies preferred to negotiate peace treaties rather than risk attack. He built border fortresses at strategic points around the country and garrisoned them not just with foot soldiers, but with the latest imported military hardware, cavalry and chariots, we're told, which in terms of the technology of warfare of those days were the sort of equivalent of jet fighters and missile launchers today. Not surprisingly, then, Solomon never had to fight a major military campaign. This deterrent policy of his was utterly successful. So if you look at chapter 4, verse 24 to 25 of 1 Kings, you'll find we read this. Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms west of the river, that's 4:24, from Tifsah to Gaza, and had peace on all sides. During Solomon's lifetime, Judah and Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, lived in safety, each man under his own vine and fig tree. And of course, a long and lasting peace of that sort is the ideal atmosphere for the flowering of culture. That was another area in which Solomon triumphed. The king himself led a remarkable renaissance in the arts and the sciences, combining his father David's musical gifts with his own wide understanding of literature and the learning of the ancient world. Solomon himself became a celebrated author and composer. Stay in that chapter 4 and look at verse 30. Solomon's wisdom was greater than the wisdom of all the men of the East and greater than all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than any other man, including Ethan the Ezrahite, wiser than Heman, Chalcol, and Dada, the sons of Mahol, and his fame spread to all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs numbered 1,005. He described plant life from the cedar of Lebanon to the hyssop that grows out of walls. He also talked about animals and birds, reptiles and fish. Men of all nations came to listen to Solomon's wisdom, sent by all the kings of the world who had heard of his wisdom. That's a remarkable description there, isn't it? Of a man who knew about everything. Some, of course, of his wisdom is actually included in Scripture, in the book of Proverbs, much of which comes from Solomon's hand. What's more, Solomon introduced advances in technology from his contact with other Middle Eastern peoples. Not just military technology, which we've already spoken about, but bronze and copper working, new styles of architecture, carving in new and superior kinds of wood. The learning he gleaned was fed into the national culture in that way, so that Israel rapidly became the showpiece of the ancient world, and as the sacred author here indicates, the tourist trade boomed as a result. People came to Israel to see all these magnificent buildings and to hear Solomon's proverbial wisdom. Of course, the most famous tourist of all was the Queen of Sheba. That's where that passage we just read in chapter 10 fits in. She obviously had some questions she wanted answers to and thought Solomon was the best man to answer them, and he didn't disappoint her. He quite, we're told in verse 5, took her breath away. There's just a touch of amusement, I think, in the way the author describes this interaction with the Queen of Sheba. When she saw all the things around her, he really put on a major diplomatic coup here, you know, rolling out the red carpet, just as Britain does to visiting Americans, actually, when we bring out all the fine regalia and have a banquet at Buckingham Palace, get them on our side. Well, Solomon wasn't above doing a bit of that, making the most of his wealth and his architecture and his regalia and so on. It wasn't only good for Israel's international prestige, It paid a handsome dividend, you see, in foreign exchange. Look at verse 23 of that chapter 10. King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth. The whole world sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom God had put in his heart. Year after year, everyone who came brought a gift. Articles of silver and gold, robes, weapons and spices, and horses and mules. Solomon, we're told in verse 26, accumulated. Bet he did. And that brings us to the third and perhaps the greatest aspect of Solomon's political genius, his economic policy. For the author tells us that with remarkable skill, Solomon exploited this strong position within the international community by developing trade links with all his surrounding neighbours. Whether it was gold imported from Africa by his merchant fleet in the Red Sea, or spices and jewels brought in on the camel caravans from Arabia, or whether it was arms deals selling Egyptian chariots to the Hittites or Sicilian horses to the Syrians, Solomon just had a genius for making money as the middleman in international trade. And where Israel was situated, of course, was just an ideal spot at that particular moment in history for such negotiations. The economy grew at a fantastic rate. So we read in 10 verse 27, the king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones, and cedar as plentiful as sycamore fig trees in the foothills. Not surprising then that even a millennium later, in the time of Jesus, Jews were still looking back to this golden age with heavy nostalgia. Ah, they said, those were the days. Solomon in all his glory. He was a great king, the greatest of their kings. And yet the disappointing thing is that in spite of his unquestionable greatness, the Bible's verdict on Solomon is an ambiguous one. He built Israel up to be a major world power. Yes, that's true. The Bible recognizes that and honors him for it. But according to the sacred historian, Solomon also sowed the seeds of her future national collapse. Solomon marks the pinnacle of Israel's prosperity. From here on in the book of Kings, the story is one of sad and sometimes very rapid decline. And Solomon it was who sowed the seed of that decline. For although he was a great king, his wisdom did not keep up with his greatness. It failed him. Oh, as I say, in his youth, things on this score had looked very, very encouraging. Turn back to the beginning of his reign, to chapter 3, verse 3, for a very important incident in this regard. We're told in 1 Kings 3, verse 3, Solomon loved the Lord, and he showed his love for the Lord by walking according to the statutes of his father David. One incident in his early reign that the author goes on to indicate demonstrates this very particularly. His dream at Gibeon. God asks Solomon in a vision what special blessing he would like to receive as his anointing for kingship. And Solomon replies in verse 7 there of chapter 3, "Oh my Lord, you have let me succeed my father as king, even though I'm very young and I don't know how to rule." So he says, "Give your servant a discerning heart. Give your servant wisdom to rule your people with justice." And we're told in verse 10, the Lord was pleased that Solomon had asked this. You haven't asked for long life or riches or the death of your enemies, he says. You've asked for wisdom. And because you have asked so prudently, I'm going to give you more wisdom than anyone has ever had before you or will ever have again. If you will walk in my ways, verse 14, and obey my statutes and commands, as David your father did, I will also give you long life. I will give you what you've not asked for, verse 13, riches and honor, so that in your lifetime you will have no equal among kings. You would hardly ask for a better start, could you? He clearly values wisdom, that wisdom that we've already seen working itself out in his intellectual interests and in his shrewdness in the economy and in politics. In fact, you'll see at the end of chapter 3 that the author of Kings goes on immediately to record one little incident from Solomon's work as judge. Because, of course, the king of Israel also functioned as the high court in matters of justice. One little incident that shows just how shrewd he could be. The two prostitutes, we're told, come to Solomon with a dispute. They have each live in the same house. They each have a child. And one of the children has died. One child is left. And the mothers are contesting whose child this remaining son is. Clearly one is the true mother, and the other, disappointed mother because of the loss of her child, is trying to take over the other woman's child. But how do you sort that out? There are no witnesses, you've only got the words of the two women. So Solomon, in a masterpiece of jurisprudence, calls in his swordsman and says in front of the women, well, we'll cut the baby in two and you can have half each. Whereupon the true mother, because she's burdened for the life of her child, says, no, I'll give up my claim. Let the child live. Let the other woman have it. Whereas the woman who is in bitterness, and not really the biological mother, she says, okay, then neither of us will have a baby. That's fair. And Solomon immediately perceives who the true mother is and gives the baby to her. Just one little snippet which the sacred historian has recorded to show us just how shrewd Solomon was in his dealings. But this wisdom of his, which God grants to him, wasn't just secular wisdom for jurisprudence, for the administration of the regime. It had a strong spiritual component in those early days too. As the author tells us, Solomon loved the Lord in those early years. And one of the ways he showed his love for God was in the spiritual priorities in his own political program. If you turn on to chapter 5 and 6, you'll find that the first thing Solomon did when he came to the throne pretty well was to continue and to finish the temple project which his father David had initiated. David's great dream had always been to build a central sanctuary in Jerusalem to the Lord, a temple. And we read that in 1 Kings 6, Solomon, having accumulated all the necessary materials and the finest materials he could obtain, actually continued and finished that project. It took 7 years to complete. It was a very ambitious project. Nothing like this temple had ever been built in Israel before. And when it was finished, Solomon, we're told in chapter 8, organizes a magnificent dedication service in which he offers one of the most eloquent and spiritual national prayers ever composed. It's a prayer that any politician would do well to meditate on. Can you, O God, really live on earth, he asks? Not even heaven is large enough to hold you, so how can this temple I have built be large enough for you? And once again, God places his seal of approval on young Solomon, fills the temple with his glory, and appears personally to Solomon, just as he seems to have done at Gibeon, perhaps 10 years earlier. I have heard your prayer, he says. I consecrate this temple you have built, in chapter 9, that is. So in those first 10 years of Solomon's administration, everything looks set for him to be not just a great king, but a good king as well, a spiritual king, a godly king, a truly wise king. But just as sometimes an early harvest fails of its promise, well, something similar happened to Solomon. Slowly but surely, as he grew older, his wisdom began to fail him. Subtly, the sacred historian records the progress of this. The first hint he gives us of it is Solomon's greater and greater interest in materialistic luxury. Once he had finished the temple, in chapter 6, we are told he immediately started work on the reconstruction of his own royal residences. And significantly, they were built to an even grander scale than the temple was. He began by building a magnificent palace for himself, at least 6 times bigger than the temple in dimensions, and he furnished it with the latest and most expensive decor. And when he'd finished that, he decided his queen ought to have a similar palace of her own too. If the national budget could have afforded these extravagances, it perhaps would not have been too serious. But Solomon's finances were already stretched by his ambitious defense policy. Remember those border fortresses, which were so important to the security of the country, they had to be built too. And then there was the vast supplying of chariots and horses and provisions for his huge standing army by which he deterred external aggressors. In spite of that considerable international trade surplus we mentioned earlier, Solomon's public spending bill got larger and larger, and the exchequer just had to find more funds. There was only one possible source. That was the people themselves. And so we begin to detect hints in 1 Kings that the extravagant lifestyle of Solomon and his huge public expenditure bill was being financed to a large extent by taxation. In chapter 4, we're told he divided the country into 12 districts. Districts that seem, in some respect, to have replaced the 12 tribes of Israel's traditional social life. Each district had to provide Solomon's provisions for 1 month of the year, we're told. That's in 4 verse 7. And in 4 verse 22, we're told what that royal requirement was. 5,000 litres of fine flour, 10,000 litres of maize meal, 30 cattle, 100 sheep, plus deer, gazelle, buck and poultry. That wasn't the annual bill, that was the daily requirement of Solomon's court, not counting all that expenditure on the garrisons and on the palaces. It was a crippling burden for what was still really a young and developing country. Solomon's luxury was being purchased effectively by the poverty of many of his people. The gap between the urban rich and the rural poor began to widen, something we see clear evidence of just a few years after Solomon's death. Nor was taxation the only indignity that Solomon foisted upon the population. We read in chapter 5, verse 13, that King Solomon drafted 30,000 men as forced labor, conscripted labor, from all over Israel. See, in the days before bulldozers and pneumatic drills, it took a lot of manpower to build big buildings out of stone. Solomon simply couldn't afford to pay the necessary wages. So he had to conscript labor by force. Every Israelite clan had to provide him with free manual labor for 4 months in every year. Now, it seems possible that a substantial amount of that forced labor was actually drawn from non-Israelite citizens who were resident in the country, which may have been politically safer for Solomon, though I suspect you and I would not feel it was any more morally acceptable. And I doubt whether all the Jews thought it was morally acceptable either. Whether it was them personally who were having to be involved in this forced labor, or their Jebusite neighbor. Because, of course, the Jews had won freedom from slavery at the cost of great hardship. Their old men still told the stories of Moses and Joshua and the austerities of their wandering in the wilderness. They still knew in their history books how they had suffered in Egypt as slaves. Canaan was supposed to be the land of freedom from slavery. That's why they had come here. And yet, here they were, building great mansions for their king, just as they had once had to do for Pharaoh in the days of their oppression in Egypt. Here they were, exploiting ethnic minorities within their own population to do that building for their king, just as Pharaoh had once exploited them as an ethnic minority in Egypt. Of course, there was only one way that Solomon could be sure the people would meet these arduous demands. He put each of these 12 administrative districts not under a local elder of the tribe, but under one of his own officers. These officers are listed again in chapter 4, and if you read, you'll find that several of them were in fact members of Solomon's own family, sons-in-laws of Solomon. If anyone then felt inclined to argue with Solomon's taxation and forced labor policy, the army wasn't far away, with its sophisticated chariots and cavalry ready to enforce the king's law at a moment's notice. And Solomon was sure that his local officials would tell him the truth of what was going on. They were his men. So it was that Israel gradually became a highly centralized military dictatorship. A wealthy and immensely powerful elite based at the capital city lived in luxury, while the rest of the population were managed by a highly efficient bureaucratic machine supported by a huge standing army. It's a scenario we're not unfamiliar with in our world today, isn't it? Not only, of course, was it thoroughly tyrannical, as far as Israel was concerned, it was also totally unconstitutional. If you have been following our series, you will know that back in Deuteronomy chapter 17, the law of Moses lays down the nature of Israelite monarchy, defines, if you like, the constitutional limitations on what Israelite monarchy may be. You can find that passage, it's quite an important one, in Deuteronomy 17 from verse 14 onwards. Just note some of the things which Moses, in the national constitution, in the law, insists about the king. The king, he says in verse 16, must not acquire great numbers of horses for himself, or make the people return to Egypt to get more horses. Verse 17, he must not accumulate large amounts of silver and gold. Verse 18, he must not consider himself better than his brothers. Now hold those phrases in your mind and just look at that chapter 10 from 1 Kings that we read earlier. Verse 26, for instance, of 1 Kings 10. Solomon accumulated chariots and horses. Our author is almost quoting from Deuteronomy 17 there and just indicating to us in a gentle but really rather unmistakable way for anybody who knows Deuteronomy that Solomon did exactly what the law of Moses said the king was not to do. He accumulated chariots and horses. Or look at verse 23. King Solomon was greater in riches than all the other kings of the earth. He must not make himself rich with silver and gold, said Deuteronomy. Or look at verse 18 of chapter 10. The king made a great throne, inlaid with ivory and overlaid with fine gold. The throne had six steps, and its back had a rounded top. On both sides of the seat were armrests with a lion standing beside each of them. Who do you think sat on that throne? Solomon did. And what had Moses said? He's not to think of himself as superior to his fellow Israelites. What was happening, you see, was that Solomon was modeling himself not on God's constitutional pattern for kingship in the law of Moses. He was modeling his style of monarchy on the totalitarian regimes of his pagan neighbors. The other monarchies of the ancient world were all tyrannies of one sort and another. And that's what Solomon was making himself to be. Nor do we have to look far to discover the source of that foreign, paganizing influence on his mindset. Look at chapter 11, verses 1 to 4. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women. Besides Pharaoh's daughters, he loved Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, and Hittites. These were the nations about which the Lord had told the Israelites, "You must not intermarry with them, because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods." Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth, and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. Now it's important to realize that it was not simply testosterone that was moving Solomon in this direction. All of these marriages were really political in nature. This vast harem was a way of making sure you had an alliance in the ancient world. Every foreign princess Solomon married represented one more foreign ally, one more foreign trading partner. This was why kings had harems in the ancient world. But no matter how politically expedient or advantageous it may have been, you see, Solomon was once again completely flouting the law of God. He was behaving in a totally unconstitutional way. Again, Deuteronomy 17 says, the king must not have many wives. This pagan model of a royal harem is out for the king of Israel, says Moses. For such a thing will turn him away from God. Such alliances are bound to have paganizing and secularizing impact on the king and breed disaster in the country. And that's exactly what happened. As Solomon reached his dotage, we're told here, he allowed himself to be manipulated by these foreign women in his court, not only allowing them to practice their pagan religion within the precincts of Jerusalem, the sacred city, but actually participating with them eventually in their idolatrous worship. As we're told in verse 5 of chapter 11, he followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Now he really can't say he wasn't warned, you see. Both at Gibeon, in that very first vision that God gave him as a young man, and then 10 years later, the dedication of the temple, when God personally spoke to him once again, on both those occasions, God made it very clear that all the blessing which he was promising Solomon was conditional upon Solomon remaining true to the pattern of moral integrity which his father David had set. If you obey me and keep my laws as your father David did. If only Solomon had heeded that if. But as I say, his wisdom did not keep pace with his greatness. So the end of Solomon's story is a sad one. Chapter 11, verse 11, we find God speaking a third and last time to Solomon. The Lord said to Solomon, since this is your attitude, referring to his idolatry, and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees which I commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David your father, I will not do it during your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. And I will not tear the whole kingdom from him, but will give him one tribe for the sake of David, my servant, and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. It was a prophecy, of course, which came true. Every word of it came true. The people put up with Solomon's increasingly tyrannical ways while he lived. He was, after all, a great king. The economy was booming, and that makes up for a lot. And the borders were secure, and Solomon's personal prestige was enormously high. So they were willing to tolerate the economic injustices and the invasions of personal liberty which he was bringing into their country. But they would not tolerate that forever. Solomon's exploitation was alienating the next generation, you see. Young militants like Jeroboam, rising up through his armed forces, were increasingly critical of Solomon's ways. And his compromise with idolatry was antagonizing the religious leaders of the nation, particularly the prophets like Ahijah and Shemaiah. Conspiracy was already in the air, even on Solomon's deathbed. And though Solomon's Gestapo were able to keep the situation under control during his lifetime, those seeds which he had sown ripened quickly after his death into revolution and schism. You can read the story in chapter 12, Israel rebels against Solomon's son, Rehoboam. It's often so, of course, that God's judgment on an ungodly regime is not seen in the lifetime of the leader himself. is seen rather in the political chaos that bursts upon the country after they've gone. There are many lessons, then, we ought to learn from the life of Solomon, particularly with the general election coming up. We ought to learn, I suspect, to beware of tyranny. Maybe with our British constitution, so-called, in place, that seems an odd thing to warn British people about. But the centralisation of power and the abuse of centralised power is something I am still very concerned about in the Western democracies, and I hope you are too. Very subtly, you see, even where a nation, as Israel did, has a constitution pledged to defend civil liberties and to keep its people free, very subtly, centralisation of power, centralisation of bureaucracy, these things rob the tribes and the individual from self-determination. John Philpot Curran makes the famous statement, "The condition upon which God has given liberty to man is eternal vigilance. Which condition, if he breaks, slavery is at once both the consequence of his crime and the punishment of his guilt." We can very easily lose liberty if we are not militant about it. We do well to beware of the subtle way in which tyranny and autocracy creeps into a country, even against the pressure of constitutional safeguards. We do well, too, to learn the danger of pluralism, for that is what really ruined Solomon. He was too tolerant towards religious and ideological alternatives. These foreign gods of his wives, you see. It may have been politically correct and politically advantageous to affirm his wives' rights as far as the worship of their own gods and goddesses were concerned. But such toleration is not regarded as a virtue in biblical ethics. It is possible to be so broad-minded as to be irresponsible. It is possible to be so unwilling to judge as to bring yourself into judgment. It is possible to be so tolerant as to be dangerously permissive. For nations are held together not just by political boundaries. They are held together by their loyalty to a common core set of values, a common culture. And religion or ideology is an absolutely indispensable part of that core of common values and culture. You can't relegate religion to anybody's private life. What we believe about the world, what we believe about God, the kind of God we believe in, hugely affects our social and moral behavior. The Lord had organized Israel on the assumption that you could only have a united and stable nation if you had a single ideological commitment to Him, the one God, the only God, and if you made the worship of other gods illegal. That was the theocratic basis of Israel. We may say such things are not appropriate in a modern pluralistic democracy like ours, and I would tend to agree with that. We must beware of trying to recreate theocracy. That isn't a Christian goal, in my view. It was one of the mistakes the Pilgrim Fathers made, I suspect, in their New England experiment, to try to rebuild theocracy. But that said, we must still beware of thinking that pluralism is innocuous. It isn't so. Our nation will fall apart if we are not united by a common set of values, by a common sense of cultural identity. And the God we believe in crucially informs that. But perhaps the chief lesson we must learn from Solomon is this lesson of our title today: the elusiveness of wisdom. It is a sad thing that an old man is more dumb than he was in his youth. That's the story of Solomon's life. It's a sad thing when you watch a government in early days having wisdom and prudence in its government gradually deteriorate to the point where it is committing acts of folly and irresponsibility. But that too we quite often see in the world. And perhaps it's even sadder when you see in the life of an individual a young man or a young woman who in their youth loved the Lord. And if asked, would rather pray for wisdom than for wealth or power. It's a sad thing to see a young woman or a young man who had that kind of spirituality about them in their youth deteriorate over the years into apostasy. But that I have seen too. It isn't true the older you get, the wisdom you get, the wiser you get. Sometimes the very opposite is true. Learn from Solomon then. Not only to begin well, but to carry on well. Let's pray together.